open and your mouth closed if you wish to acquire the habit of prompt decision. Those who talk too much do little else. If you talk more than you listen, you not only deprive yourself of many opportunities to accumulate useful knowledge, but you also disclose your plans and purposes to people who will take great delight in defeating you because they envy you. Remember also that every time you open your mouth in the presence of a person who has an abundance of knowledge, you display to that person your exact stock of knowledge or your lack of it. Genuine wisdom is usually conspicuous through modesty and silence. Keep in mind the fact that every person with whom you associate is, like yourself, seeking the opportunity to accumulate money. If you talk about your plans too freely, you may be surprised when you learn that some other person has beaten you to your goal by putting into action ahead of you the plans of which you talked unwisely. Let one of your first decisions be to keep a closed mouth and open ears and eyes. As a reminder to yourself to follow this advice, it will be helpful if you copy the following epigram in large letters and place it where you will see it daily. Tell the world what you intend to do, but first, show it. This is the equivalent of saying that deeds and not words are what count most. Freedom or death on a decision. The value of decisions depends upon the courage required to render them. The great decisions, which served as the foundation of civilization, were reached by assuming great risks, which often meant the possibility of death. Lincoln's decision to issue his famous Proclamation of Emancipation, which gave freedom to the colored people of America, was rendered with full understanding that his act would turn thousands of friends and political supporters against him. He knew, too, that the carrying out of that proclamation would mean death to thousands of men on the battlefield. In the end, it cost Lincoln his life. That required courage. Socrates' decision to drink the cup of poison, rather than compromise in his personal belief, was a decision of courage. It turned time ahead 1,000 years and gave to people then unborn the right to freedom of thought and of speech. The decision of General Robert E. Lee, when he came to the parting of the way with the Union and took up the cause of the South, was a decision of courage, for he well knew that it might cost him his own life, that it would surely cost the lives of others. But the greatest decision of all time, as far as any American citizen is concerned, was reached in Philadelphia, July 4, 1776, when 56 men signed their names to a document which they well knew would bring freedom to all Americans or leave every one of the 56 hanging from a gallows. You have heard of this famous document, but you may not have drawn from it the great lesson in personal achievement it so plainly taught. We all remember the date of this momentous decision, but few of us realize what courage that decision required. We remember our history as it was taught. We remember dates and the names of the men who fought. We remember Valley Forge and Yorktown. We remember George Washington and Lord Cornwallis. But we know little of the real forces back of these names, dates, and places. We know still less of that intangible power which ensured us freedom long before Washington's armies reached Yorktown. We read the history of the Revolution and falsely imagine that George Washington was the father of our country, that it was he who won our freedom. While the truth is, Washington was only an accessory after the fact, because victory for his armies had been ensured long before Lord Cornwallis surrendered. This is not intended to rob Washington of any of the glory he so richly merited. Its purpose, rather, is to give greater attention to the astounding power that was the real cause of his victory. It is nothing short of tragedy that the writers of history have missed, entirely, even the slightest reference to the irresistible power which gave birth and freedom to the nation destined to set up new standards of independence for all peoples of the earth. I say it is a tragedy because it is the self-same power which must be used by every individual who surmounts the difficulties of life and forces life to pay the price asked. Let us briefly review the events which gave birth to this power. The story begins with an incident in Boston, March 5, 1770. British soldiers were patrolling the streets. By their presence, openly threatening the citizens, the colonists resented armed men marching in their midst. They began to express their resentment openly, hurling stones as well as epithets at the marching soldiers until the commanding officer gave orders, "Fix bayonets! Charge!" The battle was on. It resulted in the death and injury of many. The incident aroused such resentment that the Provincial Assembly, made up of prominent colonists, called a meeting for the purpose of taking definite action. Two of the members of that assembly were John Hancock and Samuel Adams. Long live their names. They spoke up courageously and declared that a move must be made to eject all British soldiers from Boston. Remember this. A decision in the minds of two men might properly be called the beginning of the freedom which we of the United States now enjoy. Remember, too, that the decision of these two men called for faith and courage because it was dangerous. Before the assembly adjourned, Samuel Adams was appointed to call on the governor of the province, Hutchinson, and demand the withdrawal of the British troops. The request was granted. The troops were removed from Boston. But the incident was not closed. It had caused a situation destined to change the entire trend of civilization. Strange, is it not, how the great changes, such as the American Revolution and the World War, often have their beginnings in circumstances which seem unimportant. It is interesting also to observe that these important changes usually begin in the form of a definite decision in the minds of a relatively small number of people. Few of us know the history of our country well enough to realize that John Hancock, Samuel Adams, and Richard Henry Lee of the province of Virginia were the real fathers of our country. Richard Henry Lee became an important factor in this story by reason of the fact that he and Samuel Adams communicated frequently by correspondence, sharing freely their fears and their hopes concerning the welfare of the people of their provinces. From this practice, Adams conceived the idea that a mutual exchange of letters between the 13 colonies might help to bring about the coordination of efforts so badly needed in connection with the solution of their problems. 2 years after the clash with the soldiers in Boston, March 72, Adams presented this idea to the Assembly in the form of a motion that a correspondence committee be established among the colonies, with definitely appointed correspondents in each colony, for the purpose of friendly cooperation for the betterment of the colonies of British America. Mark well this incident. It was the beginning of the organization of the far-flung power designed to give freedom to you and to me. The mastermind had already been organized. It consisted of Adams, Lee, and Hancock. I tell you further that if two of you agree upon the earth concerning anything for which you ask, it will come to you from my Father, who is in heaven. The Committee of Correspondence was organized. Observe that this move provided the way for increasing the power of the mastermind by adding to it men from all the colonies. Take notice that this procedure constituted the first organized planning of the disgruntled colonists. In union, there is strength. The citizens of the colonies had been waging disorganized warfare against the British soldiers through incidents similar to the Boston riot but nothing of benefit had been accomplished. Their individual grievances had not been consolidated under one mastermind. No group of individuals had put their hearts, minds, souls, and bodies together in one definite decision to settle their difficulty with the British once and for all, until Adams, Hancock, and Lee got together. Meanwhile, the British were not idle. They, too, were doing some planning and masterminding on their own account, with the advantage of having back of them money and organized soldiery. The Crown appointed Gage to supplant Hutchinson as the governor of Massachusetts. One of the new governor's first acts was to send a messenger to call on Samuel Adams for the purpose of endeavoring to stop his opposition by fear. We can best understand the spirit of what happened by quoting the conversation between Colonel Fenton, the messenger sent by Gage, and Adams. Colonel Fenton, I have been authorized by Governor Gage to assure you, Mr. Adams, that the governor has been empowered to confer upon you such benefits as would be satisfactory, endeavor to win Adams by promise of bribes, upon the condition that you engage to cease in your opposition to the measures of the government. It is the governor's advice to you, sir, not to incur the further displeasure of His Majesty. Your conduct has been such as makes you liable to penalties of an act of Henry the Eighth, by which persons can be sent to England for trial for treason, or misprison of treason, at the discretion of a governor of a province. But by changing your political course, you will not only receive great personal advantages, but you will make your peace with the king. Samuel Adams had the choice of two decisions. He could cease his opposition and receive personal bribes, or he could continue and run the risk of being hanged. Clearly, the time had come when Adams was forced to reach instantly a decision which could have cost his life. The majority of men would have found it difficult to reach such a decision. The majority would have sent back an evasive reply, but not Adams. He insisted upon Colonel Fenton's word of honor that the colonel would deliver to the governor the answer exactly as Adams would give it to him. Adams' answer. Then you may tell Governor Gage that I trust I have long since made my peace with the King of Kings. No personal consideration shall induce me to abandon the righteous cause of my country. And tell Governor Gage, it is the advice of Samuel Adams to him, no longer to insult the feelings of an exasperated people. Comment as to the character of this man seems unnecessary. It must be obvious to all who hear this astounding message that its sender possessed loyalty of the highest order. This is important. Racketeers and dishonest politicians have prostituted the honor for which such men as Adams died. When Governor Gage received Adams' caustic reply, he flew into a rage and issued a proclamation which read, I do hereby, in His Majesty's name, offer and promise His most gracious pardon to all persons who shall forthwith lay down their arms and return to the duties of peaceable subjects, accepting only from the benefit of such pardon Samuel Adams and John Hancock, whose offenses are of too flagitious a nature to admit of any other consideration but that of condign punishment. As one might say in modern slang, Adams and Hancock were on the spot. The threat of the irate governor forced the two men to reach another decision, equally as dangerous. They hurriedly called a secret meeting of their staunchest followers. Here the mastermind began to take on momentum. After the meeting had been called to order, Adams locked the door, placed the key in his pocket, and informed all present that it was imperative that a Congress of the colonists be organized, and that no man should leave the room until the decision for such a Congress had been reached. Great excitement followed. Some weighed the possible consequences of such radicalism, old man fear. Some expressed grave doubt as to the wisdom of so definite a decision in defiance of the crown. Locked in that room were two men immune to fear, blind to the possibility of failure, Hancock and Adams. Through the influence of their minds, the others were induced to agree that, through the Correspondence Committee, arrangements should be made for a meeting of the First Continental Congress to be held in Philadelphia September 5, 1774. Remember this date. It is more important than July 4, 1776. If there had been no decision to hold a Continental Congress, there could have been no signing of the Declaration of Independence. Before the first meeting of the new Congress, another leader, in a different section of the country, was deep in the throes of publishing a summary view of the rights of British America. He was Thomas Jefferson, of the province of Virginia, whose relationship to Lord Dunmore, representative of the crown in Virginia, was as strained as that of Hancock and Adams with their governor. Shortly after his famous Summary of Rights was published, Jefferson was informed that he was subject to prosecution for high treason against His Majesty's government. Inspired by the threat, one of Jefferson's colleagues, Patrick Henry, boldly spoke his mind, concluding his remarks with a sentence which shall remain forever a classic. If this be treason, then make the most of it. It was such men as these who, without power, without authority, without military strength, without money, sat in solemn consideration of the destiny of the colonies, beginning at the opening of the First Continental Congress, and continuing at intervals for 2 years, until on June 7, 1776, Richard Henry Lee arose, addressed the chair, and to the startled assembly made this motion. Gentlemen, I make the motion that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they be absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. Lee's astounding motion was discussed fervently, and at such length that he began to lose patience. Finally, after days of argument, he again took the floor and declared in a clear, firm voice, "Mr. President, we have discussed this issue for days. It is the only course for us to follow. Why then, sir, do we longer delay? Why still deliberate? Let this happy day give birth to an American republic. Let her arise, not to devastate and to conquer, but to reestablish the reign of peace and of law. The eyes of Europe are fixed upon us. She demands of us a living example of freedom that may exhibit a contrast in the felicity of the citizen to the ever-increasing tyranny." Before his motion was finally voted upon, Lee was called back to Virginia because of serious family illness. But before leaving, he placed his cause in the hands of his friend, Thomas Jefferson, who promised to fight until favorable action was taken. Shortly thereafter, the President of the Congress, Hancock, appointed Jefferson as chairman of a committee to draw up a Declaration of Independence. Long and hard the committee labored on a document which would mean, when accepted by the Congress, that every man who signed it would be signing his own death warrant should the colonies lose in the fight with Great Britain, which was sure to follow. The document was drawn, and on June 28th, the original draft was read before the Congress. For several days it was discussed, altered, and made ready. On July 4th, 1776, Thomas Jefferson stood before the assembly and fearlessly read the most momentous decision ever placed upon paper. "When in the course of human events, It is necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume, among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. When Jefferson finished, the document was voted upon, accepted, and signed by the 56 men, every one staking his own life upon his decision to write his name. By that decision came into existence a nation destined to bring to mankind forever the privilege of making decisions. By decisions made in a similar spirit of faith, and only by such decisions, can men solve their personal problems and win for themselves high estates of material and spiritual wealth. Let us not forget this. Analyze the events which led to the Declaration of Independence, and be convinced that this nation, which now holds a position of commanding respect and power among all nations of the world, was born of a decision created by a mastermind consisting of 56 men. Note well the fact that it was their decision which ensured the success of Washington's armies, because the spirit of that decision was in the heart of every soldier who fought with him, and served as a spiritual power which recognizes no such thing as failure. Note also, with great personal benefit, that the power which gave this nation its freedom is the self-same power that must be used by every individual who becomes self-determining. This power is made up of the principles described in this book. It will not be difficult to detect, in the story of the Declaration of Independence, at least six of these principles: desire, decision, faith, persistence, the mastermind, and organized planning. Throughout this philosophy will be found the suggestion that thought, backed by strong desire, has a tendency to transmute itself into its physical equivalent. Before passing on, I wish to leave with you the suggestion that one may find in this story, and in the story of the organization of the United States Steel Corporation, a perfect description of the method by which thought makes this astounding transformation. In your search for the secret of the method, do not look for a miracle, because you will not find it. You will find only the eternal laws of nature. These laws are available to every person who has the faith and the courage to use them. They may be used to bring freedom to a nation, or to accumulate riches. There is no charge, save the time necessary to understand and appropriate them. Those who reach decisions promptly and definitely know what they want and generally get it. The leaders in every walk of life decide quickly and firmly. That is the major reason why they are leaders. The world has the habit of making room for the man whose words and actions show that he knows where he is going. Indecision is a habit which usually begins in youth. The habit takes on permanency as the youth goes through graded school, high school, and even through college without definiteness of purpose. The major weakness of all educational systems is that they neither teach nor encourage the habit of definite decision. It would be beneficial if no college would permit the enrollment of any student unless and until the student declared his major purpose in matriculating. It would be of still greater benefit if every student who enters the graded schools were compelled to accept training in the habit of decision and forced to pass a satisfactory examination on this subject before being permitted to advance in the grades. The habit of indecision, acquired because of the deficiencies of our school systems, goes with the student into the occupation he chooses, if, in fact, he chooses his occupation. Generally, the youth, just out of school, seeks any job that can be found. He takes the first place he finds, because he has fallen into the habit of indecision. 98 out of every 100 people working for wages today are in the positions they hold because they lacked the definiteness of decision to plan a definite position and the knowledge of how to choose an employer. Definiteness of decision always requires courage, sometimes very great courage. 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence staked their lives on the decision to affix their signatures to that document. The person who reaches a definite decision to procure the particular job and makes life pay the price he asks does not stake his life on that decision. He stakes his economic freedom. Financial independence, riches, desirable business and professional positions are not within reach of the person who neglects or refuses to expect, plan, and demand these things. The person who desires riches in the same spirit that Samuel Adams desired freedom for the colonies is sure to accumulate wealth. In the chapter on organized planning, you will find complete instructions for marketing every type of personal services. You will find also detailed information on how to choose the employer you prefer and the particular job you desire. These instructions will be of no value to you unless you definitely decide to organize them into a plan of action. Chapter 9. Persistence. The sustained effort necessary to induce faith. The eighth step toward riches. Persistence is an essential factor in the procedure of transmuting desire into its monetary equivalent. The basis of persistence is the power of will. Willpower and desire, when properly combined, make an irresistible pair. Men who accumulate great fortunes are generally known as cold-blooded and sometimes ruthless. Often they are misunderstood. What they have is willpower, which they mix with persistence and place back of their desires to ensure the attainment of their objectives. Henry Ford has been generally misunderstood to be ruthless and cold-blooded. This misconception grew out of Ford's habit of following through in all of his plans with persistence. The majority of people are ready to throw their aims and purposes overboard and give up at the first sign of opposition or misfortune. A few carry on, despite all opposition, until they attain their goal. These few are the Fords, Carnegies, Rockefellers, and Edisons. There may be no heroic connotation to the word persistence, but the quality is to the character of man what carbon is to steel. The building of a fortune, generally, involves the application of the entire 13 factors of this philosophy. These principles must be understood. They must be applied with persistence by all who accumulate money. If you are following this book with the intention of applying the knowledge it conveys, your first test as to your persistence will come when you begin to follow the six steps described in the second chapter. Unless you are one of the 2 out of every 100 who already have a definite goal at which you are aiming and a definite plan for its attainment, you may hear the instructions and then pass on with your daily routine and never comply with those instructions. The author is checking you up at this point because lack of persistence is one of the major causes of failure. Moreover, experience with thousands of people has proved that lack of persistence is a weakness common to the majority of men. It is a weakness which may be overcome by effort. The ease with which lack of persistence may be conquered will depend entirely upon the intensity of one's desire. The starting point of all achievement is desire. Keep this constantly in mind. Weak desires bring weak results, just as a small amount of fire makes a small amount of heat. If you find yourself lacking in persistence, this weakness may be remedied by building a stronger fire under your desires. Continue to listen through to the end, then go back to chapter 2 and start immediately to carry out the instructions given in connection with the 6 steps. The eagerness with which you follow these instructions will indicate clearly how much or how little you really desire to accumulate money. If you find that you are indifferent, you may be sure that you have not yet acquired the money consciousness which you must possess before you can be sure of accumulating a fortune. Fortunes gravitate to men whose minds have been prepared to attract them, just as surely as water gravitates to the ocean. In this book may be found all the stimuli necessary to attune any normal mind to the vibrations which will attract the object of one's desires. If you find you are weak in persistence, center your attention upon the instructions contained in the chapter on power. Surround yourself with a mastermind group, and through the cooperative efforts of the members of this group, you can develop persistence. You will find additional instructions for the development of persistence in the chapters on auto-suggestion and the subconscious mind. Follow the instructions outlined in these chapters until your habit nature hands over to your subconscious mind a clear picture of the object of your desire. From that point on, you will not be handicapped by lack of persistence. Your subconscious mind works continuously while you are awake and while you are asleep. Spasmodic or occasional effort to apply the rules will be of no value to you. To get results, you must apply all of the rules until their application becomes a fixed habit with you. In no other way can you develop the necessary money consciousness. Poverty is attracted to the one whose mind is favorable to it, as money is attracted to him whose mind has been deliberately prepared to attract it and through the same laws. Poverty consciousness will voluntarily seize the mind which is not occupied with the money consciousness. A poverty consciousness develops without conscious application of habits favorable to it. The money consciousness must be created to order unless one is born with such a consciousness. Catch the full significance of the statements in the previous paragraph, and you will understand the importance of persistence in the accumulation of a fortune. Without persistence, you will be defeated, even before you start. With persistence, you will win. If you have ever experienced a nightmare, you will realize the value of persistence. You are lying in bed, half awake, with a feeling that you are about to smother. You are unable to turn over or to move a muscle. You realize that you must begin to regain control over your muscles. Through persistent effort of willpower, you finally manage to move the fingers of one hand. By continuing to move your fingers, you extend your control to the muscles of one arm until you can lift it. Then you gain control of the other arm in the same manner. You finally gain control over the muscles of one leg and then extend it to the other leg. Then, with one supreme effort of will, you regain complete control over your muscular system and snap out of your nightmare. The trick has been turned step by step. You may find it necessary to snap out of your mental inertia through a similar procedure, moving slowly at first, then increasing your speed until you gain complete control over your will. Be persistent, no matter how slowly you may at first have to move. With persistence will come success. If you select your mastermind group with care, you will have in it at least one person who will aid you in the development of persistence. Some men who have accumulated great fortunes did so because of necessity, They developed the habit of persistence because they were so closely driven by circumstances that they had to become persistent. There is no substitute for persistence. It cannot be supplemented by any other quality. Remember this, and it will hearten you in the beginning when the going may seem difficult and slow. Those who have cultivated the habit of persistence seem to enjoy insurance against failure. No matter how many times they are defeated, they finally arrive up toward the top of the ladder. Sometimes it appears that there is a hidden guide whose duty it is to test men through all sorts of discouraging experiences. Those who pick themselves up after defeat and keep on trying arrive. And the world cries, "Bravo! I knew you could do it." The hidden guide lets no one enjoy great achievement without passing the persistence test. Those who can't take it simply do not make the grade. Those who can take it are bountifully rewarded for their persistence. They receive, as their compensation, whatever goal they are pursuing. That is not all. They receive something infinitely more important than material compensation. The knowledge that every failure brings with it the seed of an equivalent advantage. There are exceptions to this rule. A few people know from experience the soundness of persistence. They are the ones who have not accepted defeat as being anything more than temporary. They are the ones whose desires are so persistently applied that defeat is finally changed into victory. We who stand on the sidelines of life see the overwhelmingly large number who go down in defeat, never to rise again. We see the few who take the punishment of defeat as an urge to greater effort. These, fortunately, never learn to accept life's reverse gear. But what we do not see, what most of us never suspect of existing, is the silent but irresistible power which comes to the rescue of those who fight on in the face of discouragement. If we speak of this power at all, we call it persistence, and let it go at that. One thing we all know, if one does not possess persistence, one does not achieve noteworthy success in any calling. As these lines are being written, I look up from my work and see before me, less than a block away, the great mysterious Broadway, the graveyard of dead hopes, and the front porch of opportunity. From all over the world, people have come to Broadway, seeking fame, fortune, power, love, or whatever it is that human beings call success. Once in a great while, someone steps out from the long procession of seekers, and the world hears that another person has mastered Broadway. But Broadway is not easily nor quickly conquered. She acknowledges talent, recognizes genius, pays off in money, only after one has refused to quit. Then we know he has discovered the secret of how to conquer Broadway. The secret is always inseparably attached to one word, persistence. The secret is told in the struggle of Fanny Hurst, whose persistence conquered the Great White Way. She came to New York in 1915 to convert writing into riches. The conversion did not come quickly, but it came. For 4 years, Miss Hurst learned about the sidewalks of New York from firsthand experience. She spent her days laboring and her nights hoping. When hope grew dim, she did not say, "All right, Broadway, you win." She said, "Very well, Broadway, you may whip some, but not me. I'm going to force you to give up." One publisher, the Saturday Evening Post, sent her 36 rejection slips before she broke the ice and got a story across. The average writer, like the average in other walks of life, would have given up the job when the first rejection slip came. She pounded the pavements for 4 years to the tune of the publisher's no, because she was determined to win. Then came the payoff. The spell had been broken. The unseen guide had tested Fanny Hurst, and she could take it. From that time on, publishers made a beaten path to her door. Money came so fast she hardly had time to count it. Then the moving picture men discovered her, and money came not in small change, but in floods. The moving picture rights to her latest novel, Great Laughter, brought $100,000, said to be the highest price ever paid for a story before publication. Her royalties from the sale of the book probably will run much more. Briefly, you have a description of what persistence is capable of achieving. Fanny Hurst is no exception. Wherever men and women accumulate great riches, you may be sure they first acquired persistence. Broadway will give any beggar a cup of coffee and a sandwich, but it demands persistence of those who go after the big stakes. Kate Smith will say, "Amen," when she hears this. For years, she sang without money and without price before any microphone she could reach. Broadway said to her, "Come and get it if you can take it." She did take it until one happy day Broadway got tired and said, "Ah, what's the use? You don't know when you're whipped, so name your price and go to work in earnest." Miss Smith named her price. It was plenty. Away up in figures so high that 1 week's salary is far more than most people make in a whole year. Verily, it pays to be persistent. And here is an encouraging statement which carries with it a suggestion of great significance. Thousands of singers who excel Kate Smith are walking up and down Broadway looking for a break without success. Countless others have come and gone. Many of them sang well enough, but they failed to make the grade because they lacked the courage to keep on keeping on, until Broadway became tired of turning them away. Persistence is a state of mind, therefore it can be cultivated. Like all states of mind, persistence is based upon definite causes. Among them, these. A. Definiteness of purpose. Knowing what one wants is the first and perhaps the most important step toward the development of persistence. A strong motive forces one to surmount many difficulties. B. Desire. It is comparatively easy to acquire and to maintain persistence in pursuing the object of an intense desire. C. Self-reliance. Belief in one's ability to carry out a plan encourages one to follow the plan through with persistence. Self-reliance can be developed through the principle described in the chapter on autosuggestion. D. Definiteness of plans. Organized plans, even though they may be weak and entirely impractical, encourage persistence. E. Accurate knowledge. Knowing that one's plans are sound, based upon experience or observation, encourages persistence. Guessing instead of knowing destroys persistence. F. Cooperation. Sympathy, understanding, and harmonious cooperation with others tend to develop persistence. G. Willpower. The habit of concentrating one's thoughts upon the building of plans for the attainment of a definite purpose leads to persistence. And H. Habit. Persistence is the direct result of habit. The mind absorbs and becomes a part of the daily experiences upon which it feeds. Fear, the worst of all enemies, can be effectively cured by forced repetition of acts of courage. Everyone who has seen active service in war knows this. Before leaving the subject of persistence, take inventory of yourself and determine in what particular, if any, you are lacking in this essential quality. measure yourself courageously, point by point, and see how many of the 8 factors of persistence you lack. The analysis may lead to discoveries that will give you a new grip on yourself. Symptoms of lack of persistence. Here, you will find the real enemies which stand between you and noteworthy achievement. Here you will find not only the symptoms indicating weakness of persistence, but also the deeply seated subconscious causes of all this weakness. Study the list carefully and face yourself squarely if you really wish to know who you are and what you are capable of doing. These are the weaknesses which must be mastered by all who accumulate riches. 1. Failure to recognize and to clearly define exactly what one wants. 2. Procrastination, with or without cause, usually backed up with a formidable array of alibis and excuses. 3. Lack of interest in acquiring specialized knowledge. 4. Indecision, the habit of passing the buck on all occasions instead of facing issues squarely, also backed by alibis. 5. The habit of relying upon alibis instead of creating definite plans for the solution of problems. 6. Self-satisfaction. There is but little remedy for this affliction and no hope for those who suffer from it. 7. Indifference. Usually reflected in one's readiness to compromise on all occasions rather than meet opposition and fight it. 8. The habit of blaming others for one's mistakes and accepting unfavorable circumstances as being unavoidable. 9. Weakness of desire, due to neglect in the choice of motives that impel action. 10. Willingness, even eagerness, to quit at the first sign of defeat, based upon one or more of the 6 basic fears. 11. Lack of organized plans, placed in writing where they may be analyzed. 12. The habit of neglecting to move on ideas or to grasp opportunity when it presents itself. 13. Wishing instead of willing. 14. The habit of compromising with poverty instead of aiming at riches. General absence of ambition to be, to do, and to own. 15. Searching for all the shortcuts to riches, trying to get without giving a fair equivalent, usually reflected in the habit of gambling, endeavoring to drive sharp bargains. And 16. Fear of criticism. Failure to create plans and to put them into action because of what other people will think, do, or say. This enemy belongs at the head of the list, because it generally exists in one's subconscious mind where its presence is not recognized. See the 6 basic fears in a later chapter. Let us examine some of the symptoms of the fear of criticism. The majority of people permit relatives, friends, and the public at large to so influence them that they cannot live their own lives because they fear criticism. Huge numbers of people make mistakes in marriage, stand by the bargain, and go through life miserable and unhappy because they fear criticism which may follow if they correct the mistake. Anyone who is submitted to this form of fear knows the irreparable damage it does by destroying ambition, self-reliance, and the desire to achieve. Millions of people neglect to acquire belated educations after having left school because they fear criticism. Countless numbers of men and women, both young and old, permit relatives to wreck their lives in the name of duty because they fear criticism. Duty does not require any person to submit to the destruction of his personal ambitions and the right to live his own life in his own way. People refuse to take chances in business because they fear the criticism which may follow if they fail. The fear of criticism in such cases is stronger than the desire for success. Too many people refuse to set high goals for themselves or even neglect selecting a career because they fear the criticism of relatives and friends who may say, "Don't aim so high. People will think you are crazy." When Andrew Carnegie suggested that I devote 20 years to the organization of a philosophy of individual achievement, my first impulse of thought was fear of what people might say. The suggestion set up a goal for me far out of proportion to any I had ever conceived. As quick as a flash, my mind began to create alibis and excuses, all of them traceable to the inherent fear of criticism. Something inside of me said, "You can't do it. The job is too big and requires too much time. What will your relatives think of you? How will you earn a living? No one has ever organized a philosophy of success. What right do you have to believe you can do it? Who are you anyway to aim so high? Remember your humble birth. What do you know about philosophy? People will think you are crazy." And they did. "Why hasn't some other person done this before now?" These and many other questions flashed into my mind and demanded attention. It seemed as if the whole world had suddenly turned its attention to me with the purpose of ridiculing me into giving up all desire to carry out Mr. Carnegie's suggestion. I had a fine opportunity then and there to kill off ambition before it gained control of me. Later in life, after having analyzed thousands of people, I discovered that most ideas are stillborn and need the breath of life injected into them through definite plans of immediate action. The time to nurse an idea is at the time of its birth. Every minute it lives gives it a better chance of surviving. The fear of criticism is at the bottom of the destruction of most ideas which never reach the planning and action stage. Many people believe that material success is the result of favorable breaks. There is an element of ground for the belief, but those depending entirely upon luck are nearly always disappointed because they overlook another important factor which must be present before one can be sure of success. It is the knowledge with which favorable breaks can be made to order. During the Depression, W.C. Fields, the comedian, lost all his money and found himself without income, without a job, and his means of earning a living, vaudeville, no longer existed. Moreover, he was past 60, when many men consider themselves old. He was so eager to stage a comeback that he offered to work without pay in a new field, movies. In addition to his other troubles, he fell and injured his neck. To many, that would have been the place to give up and quit. But Fields was persistent. He knew that if he carried on, he would get the breaks sooner or later, and he did get them, but not by chance. Marie Dressier found herself down and out, with her money gone, with no job, when she was about 60. She, too, went after the breaks and got them. Her persistence brought an astounding triumph late in life, long beyond the age when most men and women are done with ambition to achieve. Eddie Cantor lost his money in the 1929 stock crash, but he still had his persistence and his courage. With these, plus two prominent eyes, he exploited himself back into an income of $10,000 a week. Verily, if one has persistence, one can get along very well without many other qualities. The only break anyone can afford to rely upon is a self-made break. These come through the application of persistence. The starting point is definiteness of purpose. Examine the first 100 people you meet. Ask them what they want most in life, and 98% of them will not be able to tell you. If you press them for an answer, some will say security. Many will say money. A few will say happiness. Others will say fame and power. And still others will say social recognition, ease in living, ability to sing, dance, or write. But none of them will be able to define these terms or give the slightest indication of a plan by which they hope to attain these vaguely expressed wishes. Riches do not respond to wishes. They respond only to definite plans, backed by definite desires through constant persistence. How to develop persistence? There are four simple steps which lead to the habit of persistence. They call for no great amount of intelligence, no particular amount of education, and but little time or effort. The necessary steps are 1. A definite purpose backed by burning desire for its fulfillment. 2. A definite plan expressed in continuous action. 3. A mind closed tightly against all negative and discouraging influences, including negative suggestions of relatives, friends, and acquaintances. And 4. A friendly alliance with one or more persons who will encourage one to follow through with both plan and purpose. These four steps are essential for success in all walks of life. The entire purpose of the 13 principles of this philosophy is to enable one to take these four steps as a matter of habit. These are the steps by which one may control one's economic destiny. They are the steps that lead to freedom and independence of thought. They are the steps that lead to riches in smaller great quantities. They lead the way to power, fame, and worldly recognition. They are the four steps which guarantee favorable breaks. They are the steps that convert dreams into physical realities. They lead, also, to the mastery of fear, discouragement, and indifference. There is a magnificent reward for all who learn to take these four steps. It is the privilege of writing one's own ticket and of making life yield whatever price is asked. I have no way of knowing the facts, but I venture to conjecture that Mrs. Wallace Simpson's great love for a man was not accidental, nor the result of favorable breaks alone. There was a burning desire and careful searching at every step of the way. Her first duty was to love. What is the greatest thing on earth? The master called it love. Not man-made rules, criticism, bitterness, slander, or political marriages, but love. She knew what she wanted. Not after she met the Prince of Wales, but long before that. Twice, when she had failed to find it, she had the courage to continue her search. To thine own self be true, and it must follow, as the night the day, thou canst not be false to any man. Her rise from obscurity was of the slow, progressive, persistent order, but it was sure. She triumphed over unbelievably long odds, and no matter who you are, or what you may think of Wallace Simpson, or the king who gave up his crown for her love, she is an astounding example of applied persistence, an instructor on the rules of self-determination from whom the entire world might profitably take lessons. When you think of Wallace Simpson, think of the one who knew what she wanted and shook the greatest empire on earth to get it. Women who complain that this is a man's world, that women do not have an equal chance to win, owe it to themselves to study carefully the life of this unusual woman, who at an age of which most women consider old, captured the affections of the most desirable bachelor in the entire world. And what of King Edward? What lesson may we learn from his part in the world's greatest drama of recent times? Did he pay too high a price for the affections of the woman of his choice? Surely no one but he can give the correct answer. The rest of us can only conjecture. This much we know. The king came into the world without his own consent. He was born to great riches without requesting them. He was persistently sought in marriage. Politicians and statesmen throughout Europe tossed dowagers and princesses at his feet. Because he was the firstborn of his parents, he inherited a crown which he did not seek, and perhaps did not desire. For more than 40 years he was not a free agent, could not live his life on his own, had but little privacy, and finally assumed duties inflicted upon him when he ascended the throne. Some will say, With all these blessings, King Edward should have found peace of mind, contentment, and joy of living. The truth is that back of all the privileges of a crown, all the money, the fame, and the power inherited by King Edward, there was an emptiness which could be filled only